Pirate's Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Monday morning. Text line 251-343-0106. That's how you interact with the program. Coming up on the program this morning, Shane Stringer, here in about half hour. It's been a little bit since we've had him on. I think we skipped a week in there somewhere along the way. And then resumed our regular routine. So he'll be with us here in about a half hour. Paul DeMarco jumping in this morning in the 10:30 block. And then every Monday you get to hear from Dale Jackson from WVNN and Yellowhammer News. So make sure you stick around for that. Once again, text line 251-343-0106. I guess the news is all right now. The untimely death of Lindsey Graham. This is sort of the whole, I could sum it up for you. Nice guy. Did some good things. Disagreed with him a lot on his neoconservatism. But there's some truth to that. My interactions with Lindsey Graham, which are only like a few, but he is the politician's politician, and he knew how to like be very complimentary, very nice, always. I'm telling you, always will talk to reporters. And that's saying something about Capitol Hill, where you have like backbencher members of Congress who just really think that they're, you know, they're king of the world and don't talk to people, just blow right by them. But a U.S. senator is especially true on the Senate side. And there's like some really like awful people on the Senate side. And there's some like really, like just even worse than you could imagine. And people on the House side as well. But Lindsey Graham was never like I said, you really didn't like the direction he was going with foreign policy. But I think like he turned the corner. Now he's always going to win in South Carolina, always. But he kind of turned a corner in the Kavanaugh hearings. If you recall, during Trump's first term. And people kind of got on the Lindsey bandwagon there for a little while. But you could kind of see how, I guess for a while, he had established this relationship with President Trump that was documented. Trump, I guess, like at night would talk on the phone. And he kind of, for a while, he kind of goes in these spells where he likes to call the same person for a brief amount of time. And then he'll move on to someone else. And then, for better or for worse, Senator Graham was one of those. But he had the president's ear on a lot of stuff and probably had the president's ear on this Iran fiasco or whatever you want to call it. I guess the other part of this kind of stunned some of the people, the way people react over someone dying. And this is not just a critique of left-wingers, although they are feel very emboldened to come out and criticize someone in death. But the right's doing it right now, too. He was not a fan of, you know, I mean, they were not a fan of his in some circles in Republican or I didn't call it Republican, maybe conservative circles. But like the other thing he'll be remembered, it was kind of a little wishy-washy on immigration, Lindsey Grahamnesty. We're kind of sitting up here. I was doing some work, and it was 1 in the morning when the news broke on Sunday morning, getting the 18-19 page ready, and that came across. But he's also a guy, never turned away TV interviews. Was on Fox News a lot. Early in his career, he was on the Sunday shows a lot. There was always two or three or four you could count on a Sunday show. Joe Lieberman, John McCain, Joe Biden, and Lindsey Graham were always in the mix. On one of the, you know, because you had this week on ABC and Meet the Press on NBC, and you had Face the Nation, and then later you got the Fox News show. But on one of those shows, at least one of those four senators throughout the early 2000s, you would get always one of those four. So the question now is, what happens? Who is going to fill that void in South Carolina? There's some real potential here. And I think the prospects of Save America are probably not good. Getting anything done last ditch before the August, well, it is the August recess, but before the new Congress. So it's going to take some election wins probably to move the ball on that. But that's the big news. And then we're also hearing stuff about Mitch McConnell and the spin there. Like, who I'm sure is still like alive in a theoretic sense, but he's not dead. But probably there's a little bit of a KIV play here. And they're propping him up for whatever reason. But it's not much longer. There'll be a new senator from Kentucky. Speaking of KIV, I was thinking about this. Mark Sanford, do you remember him? So he is the governor of South Carolina, and he disappears for a weekend, I guess on a rendezvous with his Argentinian mistress, soulmate. But he told everybody, remember the Appalachian Trail? Because it was like this breaking news story. Where's the South Carolina governor? And it was like this utmost important thing that no one knows where he... Well, they had never done that with the Alabama governor. There's one thing you got to give it to the KIV folks. They just totally like owned the avoid any kind of public scrutiny of her health, of her functionality, of any of that. They have. It's not shown up on any national radar. We've talked about it. We talked about it Friday on the show with Senator Elliott. Like, okay, there's this really big decision being made about tolling and this bridge. And no one really knows if Kay Hivey was the one who made that call. Well, I was thinking about that in relation to Mark Sanford. Hell, he just disappears for a few hours and everybody freaks out. Kyvie's been gone for like 5 years. And we kind of shrug it off. What do I know? Speaking of Alabama politics here, this is kind of... Do you remember the whole discussion about closing primaries? And we had Todd Stacey on Friday talk about this. And, oh, it would just be bad if they did that. You'd have radical right wingers, in the halls of power in Montgomery. Well, this isn't going to help the cause for that crowd. It's Tabitha Iser, who's the vice chairwoman of the Alabama Democratic Party. Yes, we have a Democratic Party in Alabama, a functioning one, sort of functioning. Because of social media, tells Democrats to go vote Republican primary on August 11th. in the congressional special. She is telling Democrats, the leadership of the Alabama Democratic Party. I don't know where Randy Kelly, he's the chairman, or Joe Reed, who's really sort of the party boss, what they're saying. But the vice chairwoman said, Democrats, go vote a Republican primary on August 11th. Like, if we're assembling a court case and showing evidence of why this is something that Republicans and the Republican supermajority Alabama legislature needs to do, is closing primaries, this would be at the top of the list. That the actual leader of one of the leaders, one of the top leaders of the Alabama Democratic Party, is telling her membership to vote in the other party's primary. Now, what do they get out of that? I don't know. Oh, it's not really a thing. You don't want to close the primaries because then you'll get another guy, hun, and we'll have to send him off to Atlanta to be coached up. And you'll have this hayseed hillbilly as our governor. We don't want that. He won't even know how to use a fork. What? No. You don't want, like, left-wingers voting in your primaries. That's the story here. It seems like an odd thing for people who allege to be, like, you know, pro-Trump fighting conservatives to oppose. But this doesn't help their case. One-party state. The lesson there was that In 86, Charlie Graddick wins the Democratic Party primary for governor. They determined that he is was voted on by too many Republicans in a Democratic Party primary, so they take it away from him and give it to Bill Baxley. And Bill Baxley loses because of this phenomenon. To Guy Hunt, who apparently didn't even know how to use a fork, knife, or a spoon, because that's what they do in Holly Pond, Alabama. They eat with their hands, I guess. But he becomes governor, and he has a very aggressive Democratic Party, good old boy network working against him the entire time, and so Jimmy Evans, who was the attorney general at the time, prosecutes him. And there were probably some indiscretions there, you know, but it's this. George Wallace, who was his predecessor, had a set of rules that he lived by and got away with it. And the next governor, especially of the opposition party, was not going to have that same privilege, I suppose. But, Democrats voting Republican primaries, it's there. We have the evidence, Your Honor. 251-343-0106. If you want to be in touch with the show, text me. We're going to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. Welcome back to the Jeff Porter Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Monday morning, 251-343-0106. If you want to be in touch with the show, all you do is text us. Still to come in the next segment, we'll hear from Shane Stringer, one of our Monday regulars here on the program. Just a few texts to get to. Fire Dog kicks us off with, there's a lot I could say about politician Lindsey Graham that I can't fit into a text. When I was in D.C. at the Pentagon, we never crossed paths. I did have many interactions with Joe Lieberman, and he was always a class act. I did like him. We traded letters for a few years after I got out of the military. Squirrel Vereen, top of the eyes, there's a complete, total, complete stereotypical Alabama liberal white woman trash. She adopted a black foreign boy and sent him to a private Catholic school, which goes against left-wing tenets of whitewashing, cultural appropriation, and school choice. Plus, she looks like a kooky bird. She's certainly a radical. I was like, I got to know who she was. Well, she ran against Martha Roby, I guess it was 2018. She was the Democrat nominee. This was right after Roby had to win a Republican runoff against Bobby Bright for the that House seat. And she's kind of been a fixture in Democratic Party politics ever since. She may be what you say she is, but she's still a leader of the Democratic Party, and she still is urging Democrats to vote in the Republican primary. I named texture. My dad was good friends with Guy Hunt. He said Guy was a good man who took bad advice from his helpers. Imagine a rural probate judge who is suddenly made governor. Yeah, because Republicans just really didn't. No one thought a Republican could win in 1986 in Alabama. It was a very strange election cycle. You think about pre-straight ticket voting in Alabama. Jeremiah Denton was U.S. Senator, and he had made some just boneheaded remarks. So he was a Republican. He made some boneheaded remarks about coming back to campaign, and it got out. I mean, it was just like, why would I come back to Alabama and kiss babies and do stuff like that? I got important stuff to do in Washington, D.C., and that opened the door for Richard Shelby, a congressman from the 7th Congressional District. And I guess it was the 7th. I'm not sure what it was at the time. But he was congressman, and he wins that U.S. Senate seat as a Democrat, defeats the Republican. So on the ballot that cycle, you had a Democrat win a U.S. Senate seat, but you had a Republican win the gubernatorial election. What voter turnout was like back then. And then the Guy Hunt era was, aside from his departure from office, wasn't that remarkable. And it was, we got Mercedes-Benz, a detail in there, but it was with little Jim Folsom, who was lieutenant governor, who had to fill that void. I think Guy Hunt ran for state senate and lost years later. She couldn't even win. I mean, and just in the aftermath of leaving office, just in disgrace, I guess, although it was not a fair fight, the establishment, the deck was stacked against the Republican governor. But such as it was, he leaves office. He comes, tries to do a stage of comeback for state senate. They don't. Did you know? I've always seen the signs that there is a Guy Hunt gubernatorial library at Holly Pond. True story. I wonder what the K. Ivey Library will be like. I could see George Wallace or Big Jim Folsom, maybe even Bob Riley. Then the Bentley Library. Then it cried just south of Nashville. Siegelman. Look at the fascinating aspects of Alabama political history, nonetheless. 251-343-0106. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Many thanks. He said, you don't have to call me Mr. Mister. The whole world.
Said, can you make folks cry when you play and sing? Have you paid? Good and laughing.
to the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Monday morning. 251-343-0106. Hit us up on that text line. We'll get to your text over the next few segments, so please keep them coming. Still to come on the program, my friend Paul DeMarco at about an hour. And then at the near the conclusion of the broadcast, we'll hear from Dale Jackson from WVNN and Yellowhammer News. So please stay tuned for that. Joining us now on the line, it's been a few weeks, but we're always glad to be joined by State Representative Shane Stringer. Representative, good morning. How are you?
Doing great, Jeff. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Thanks for making time. We do appreciate it. Well, it's how's the off season going for you? It's summer months, and it's a lot of election politics, but much going on legislative wise.
No, it's not too bad. Just answering a few phone calls here and there, and just trying to help constituents out with their issues. But other than that, it's not too busy.
Well, it's it's one of those lulls in the action that's probably appreciated by a lot of us. So, we'll be gearing up for the new session. I guess one of the things, and I guess this is the obligatory question, sort of your reaction to what you the Governor Ivey toll bridge proposal. I mean, it's not your district necessarily, but I'm sure it's going to impact a lot of people from your House district.
Yeah, I think so. It's one of those projects that's absolutely needed and we've got to do something. But on the other hand, you've also got a lot of opposition to the any toll. So not sure how that's going to play out far as the constituents. But, I know we've got to do something somehow, some way to get this project going to alleviate some of that stress.
Yeah, it's just the timing of it, and I get it. There's federal money that's going to lapse if we don't act soon, but I don't think this is something that people are fully aware of. I know that they're going to give a bunch of workarounds for locals and people they think we're going to get passes and commuter, unlimited things of that sort. But man, $7.70 is going to, there's going to be some sticker shock there from that commuter traffic passing through Alabama.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know how that's going to play out. Luckily, I don't have to use it as much, so it's not going to affect, myself. But for the ones it is going to affect, that's going to be pretty stiff. And on top of everything else with, all the inflation and stuff that we've seen over the last 15, 20 years, it's going to be tough on people.
Yeah, well, I guess that's to be continued, but I'd be surprised if it's if it proceeds as is. There's got to be some things to try to nibble around the edges, at least get it down a little bit. But what that may be, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm sure myself and everybody will fight tooth and nail to try to get either the lowest toll we can or no toll to try to help out our constituents and help people out the best we can. But I don't know in the long run, what it's going to take to make this project happen. So I've not had a lot of opportunities to do a deep dive into the latest proposal and what we're looking at. So I'll need to do that a little bit before I, see what we do need and don't need at this point.
Well, like a couple of things that just kind of bounce these off of, because we don't have all the details, but the two things I'm kind of interested in, what if they want to increase the toll? What's the mechanism there? How will that work? Does it just go to this rubber stamp toll authority or what? And then the other aspect would be, when does the toll end? Like is there a plan in place that when this is paid or the notes paid on it or whatever, the bonding, that the toll goes away and then it's sort of like, any other toll road, around the South that, they have one in Atlanta for a while and then they paid off the road and Kentucky, the system there with the turnpikes and, places around where we've done this. And then ultimately it becomes a free route.
Yeah, and we've seen it locally with that. The Bankhead Tunnel, I think, was tolled at one point when it was built, and it was removed at some point. Foley Beach Express or the bypass going into Orange Beach was told, and that was done away at some point. So, you know, those are good questions. That's the kind of stuff that we want to see and hear, that there's not going to be some kind of extended or lifelong toll on the bridge, that once it's the toll and the bridge and projects paid for, that it's removed. And that's what the questions that's going to be asked.
The design of it, I mean, it's going to be a massive project. It's going to be the biggest project the state's ever done as far as highways. And this is the question I asked Sarah Elliott on Friday, is like, look, we got a new governor coming in and is presumably a new ALDOT director, but just kind of where we are today. I mean, do you feel good about trusting these people to do the right thing here? And I got some reservations at least.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, the land around the Civic Center in Mobile and the I-10 Virginia Street area had already been purchased and, you know, cleared off. And a lot of the work has already been done paving the way for this project. And, you know, with us expanding the port and trying to, you know, make it bigger and better, and the port basically affects every district in Mobile County. I know a lot of my people work at the steel mills, and we've got the Amazon shipping centers and Airbus and Austal and all of those that are affected by the port and getting the products in and out to be to our ports is extremely important. So I think we've absolutely got to do something. And I think that there's a lot of good work going into it, trying to make sure that the future for our port is ready. And that I-10 project's just as important for that as it is for commerce and anything else we're looking at.
Yeah. And, you know, the free routes, I guess that kind of comes close to your district there with the Cochrane Bridge. Africatown Crockett Bridge, that is, and there are options here, but I wonder about the burden on traffic once you route people a so-called free route, that there's going to be some unintended consequences here, especially coming down 45 or 43 or whatever, and you're crossing over there to go to the beach. That's the way you go if you're coming from that part of the north, and now you're going to have toll dodgers also, you know, so like all this sort of comes in together.
Yeah, and that's a likely problem. We have seen similar whenever they finished up the 158 project going from Saraland out to Mississippi, the Mississippi line there near Loosedale, George County. They shut down Moffett Road for a while there, rerouting traffic onto the new road, and after a while there's so much congestion there at 158 and Saraland and 65 that, you know, they did open up Moffett Road, but it's still not as used, and so they're dealing with a lot of problems, issues, and congestion there in Saraland. So yeah, I'm sure there's going to be some issues and concerns that are going to have to be worked out once this is put in place.
Well, you know, and the one last thing on this is I wonder how this is going to impact other projects down here. So if you get this big bridge and the state transportation policymakers are looking at the state, and, you know, every state, every part of the state has its needs, will this suck up the likelihood of widening 45 or finishing 158 or, you know, whatever else needs to be done in North Mobile County, or Baldwin County for that matter, for the foreseeable future, because, well, you're getting your big giant bridge.
Yeah, that is possible. So that is things that we look at. Of course, we looked at that whenever they started discussing and working on the West Alabama corridor, 43 north of Thomasville, and those concerns have been brought up, and trying to, you know, make the best of our funds and make sure that we're using them wisely across the state, not just in one area, one road. So I don't know. It's going to be, we're all going to have to keep a close eye on it as we do budgets and, you know, there's just going to have to be a lot of legislators looking at the cost of this project versus the money we've had and see what we've got and, you know, what we're able to do with this.
Well, it's just kind of always stunning to me, and I don't know if it's like this in other states, but legislators really have very limited influence on road projects. And it's a core executive function. Whenever I bring this question up, it's like, well, you don't want politics coming into play on road construction. Well, you kind of do, because then that stops these boondoggle type projects like the West Alabama corridor from happening. That you, if it were a disparate based system and they looked at traffic counts and they actually did that, and instead of trying to make our roads and highways some kind of economic development program, you know, that things would be, I think, tangibly better.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we absolutely need a say-so in it. We are representatives from our district in our area of the state. And if we're not having a say-so, we can't go back and work on major projects like Highway 45 or 158. Then there's problems. I mean, if we can't influence that, then who can? And you're going to have projects like Highway 45 that's, you know, been left out. I mean, we have been a squeaky wheel since I've gotten elected about that, and going to continue to do so until we get something done. But the legislators, you know, that process has got to have a part in deciding which roads are paved and four-laned and updated and upgraded across our state.
I mean, I remember the discussions about the gas tax in 2019. And I had a bunch of lawmakers. Everybody was kind of forced to be on board. They had a gun to their head on that. And the one of the things that was always told to me was, like, we're going to have this joint oversight committee of House members and senators. It's going to be fantastic because we're going to make sure that there's no silly, frivolous spending. We're going to keep this Department of Transportation in check. And you could trust us here because we're the watchdogs. And then the governor goes out and bonds for the next 20 years on this money that was supposedly going to be under the watchful eye of the legislature. And I can't imagine. And I've had conversations on the record with, like, the speaker and the pro tem that they don't like the way she did this. And they kind of, like, snuck one past the goal line here.
Yeah, I think there's got to be checks and balances. And, you know, I'm not sure how that happened, but we've got to have ways that we can slow a project down or stop it if need be, if we get somebody that does something that don't need to be done. So, I think we've got to have a say so. We've got to be able to have some checks and balances, and we can't have one person, you know, whether it be the governor, lieutenant governor, whoever, making decisions on major road projects that's going to tie the money of the state for extended periods of time.
Yeah, I guess we're just kind of stuck with the status quo. I mean, and not to make this whole discussion about roads, I guess that's where we went today with it, but, like, there's just no going back on the West Alabama corridor. They decided this is something they wanted to do, and they put every egg possible in that basket. And it's probably going to get done the way the governor and John Cooper, the ADOT director, had envisioned.
Yeah. You know, which I do travel that area, and it, you know, it will definitely help my travels in traveling that road. But whether it was the most needed project in the state, I don't think so. But, you know, I think that we, anytime we can four lane or expand a road in Alabama, we need to do it. Of course, I'm advocating for my district the best I can, but I'm not opposed to upgrading and updating other areas of the state also for all of our citizens.
Well, tell me this. If they do 45 someday, and we're old men when we're talking about it, do they have to build like a brand new bypass around Citronelle, or could they do something there just to check the box?
Yeah, it could absolutely be done through town. It does not have to be bypassed. You know, there have been some talks of that over the years, and, you know, I'm not sure exactly what that was about, but it was four lane through town before, you know, about, I'd say before 2011. it was four lane through town, and they went back and changed it to the two lanes with a middle lane, turning passing lane there, or turning lane. And to me, it's been more problematic since we've done that than having the four lane. But that's, you know, those kind of conversations or talks are going to have to be had and made throughout projects, and trying to make sure we're doing what's best, what can be done, and what's financially affordable. But yeah, that one is absolutely doable. And, you know, the price that it would cost to bypass the city would be, to me, it would outweigh the cost and benefit of going through the city there in Central Mill.
Representative, we got to get out of here. Thanks for making time for us. We'll do it again in a couple of weeks.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
State Representative Shane Stringer there, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. To the Jeff Porter Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for sticking with us on this Monday morning. 251-343-0106. You need to be in touch with the program. Hit us up on that text line. Good morning, Jeff. This is what I named Texter. The American First Conservative feel the same way about Graham's passing as they felt about McCain's passing. They were about themselves and power that comes from being senator, not about serving the voters who elected them, because they had donors with very deep pockets that will provide them resources to win every election. This is why there should be term limits. Let me say this. I don't think Lindsey Graham and John McCain are great examples of that, because, Arizona and South Carolina always elected those two gentlemen. Always. I think they were true believers. And you may be right to a certain degree about power, because the power they had made them think that they could be these masters of the universe and achieve world peace or whatever. That they wanted to be players on the international stage. I think it was less about campaign donations and less about money and more just about like this world vision these guys had in mind. That they really, really did want like things they thought were positives. They wanted world peace. They wanted the United States to be the responsible actor on the global stage. But they're just U.S. senators. That's more of an executive branch function. John McCain and Lindsey Graham both ran for president. But that was their world policy view. And here they are, domestic U.S. senators. And not that the U.S. Senate shouldn't have a say in foreign policy. Obviously, it does. But that's where their leanings were. Very hawkish. They say pro-military, not pro-military in the sense of pro-troops, but pro-defense spending. Pro-weapon systems. Big, badder, more effective military. And not afraid to use it if needed. It just, you always think about this, about 2008 and that election. And how John McCain was sort of an odd fit for the Republican Party at the time. Because at the time, guys, I mean, McCain was a neocon. But the country had kind of moved on from Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, 2006, there was a fork in the road, and we had, you know, Democrats take over. And then 07 and 08, you had financial calamity. You had a housing bubble that burst. You had all kinds of bad mortgages that were written and insured with, you know, a lot of people lost a lot of wealth. So the discussion went from anti-war to economy in a hurry. But I just discount that aspect of your comment that it was all about making their campaign financiers happy, because these were guys who were always going to win their reelection bids no matter who ran against them or what. And I can't explain Arizona and South Carolina politics, but that's just how it was. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Somebody take me home through.